Not at all safe. Bren looks up from her computer screen. Bren, what do we want to do? What do we want to say? Me. I think there should be only two characters so we don't have to pay anyone. Bren nods and types this. Pause. Bren, do you want to go watch the Jamie Kennedy experiment? Me, totally. This went on for months. We could spend the entire hour arguing about the plausibility of Harry Potter and not write a single word. In the early aughts, the actors Matt Damon and Ben Affleck loomed large in our lives. They loomed large in everyone's lives, actually. This was the height of Bennifer. Sorry, I hate to resuscitate that term, which the media has thankfully put to bed, but it's important to remember what a phenomenon it was. It was like Pippa Middleton plus Beyonce's legs times the iPad. Bennifer was so big, it was as though two people had never been in love before. I think it's also easy to forget that Bennifer created the trend of the blended celebrity couple name. Without Bennifer, we wouldn't have Brangelina or Tomcat, or even the less used Jabrobra, which is James Brolin and Barbra Streisand, of course. That is the gift that Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez gave us that has withstood the test of time. Bran and I have always done bits, even before we knew they were called bits. Bits are essentially nonsense time, or to describe it more pejoratively, fucking around. We would take on characters, acting like them for a while on the way to the subway or getting ready to go out. For whatever reason, around this time, our favorite recurring bit was when Bren played Matt Damon and I played Ben Affleck. We played the guys very naturalistically, but they had a slightly jock-like dude posture and slightly lower voices. Again, have I emphasized how well we fit into our lesbian neighborhood? Soon, our Matt and Ben had a rich and completely made-up backstory and dynamic. They had private jokes and shared memories, again, all made up. We did no research on the actual people because we didn't care about their actual pasts. The real Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were simply jumping off points for our Matt and Ben. It was a special kind of fun to be two best friends playing two other best friends. Once we had our characters, albeit nutty ones, we gained focus. If I can give one bit of advice to any drama major, high school theater kid, or inmate who is reading this in a prison library with dreams of being cast in the prison play, it's this. Write your own part. It is the only way I've gotten anywhere. It is much harder work, but sometimes you have to take destiny into your own hands. It forces you to think about what your strengths really are, and once you find them, you can showcase them, and no one can stop you. I wasn't going to be able to showcase what I did best in an off-off-Broadway revival of Our Town. I was going to do it playing Ben Affleck. The premise for Matt and Ben is weird but simple. The script for Good Will Hunting falls from the ceiling of a 21-year-old Ben Affleck's apartment while the two are working on a screen adaptation of Catcher in the Rye. They stop work and wonder about the significance of what has happened. The tone is somewhere between The X-Files and The Odd Couple. Here's one of the first scenes we wrote. Matt has arrived late to meet Ben, who is annoyed at him. Matt is late because he was auditioning for a play. Matt and Ben.
And I had to go to this thing first, and then I came here.
What thing?
Nothing, just this audition thing.
For what?
For nothing. You don't know Shepard, Sam Shepard?
Yeah, of course.
You do?
Yeah, he was in the Pelican Brief. I love that guy. With the wrinkles? Is he in the play?
No, he wrote the play. This play called Buried Child, won a Pulitzer. Anyway, it was nothing. It didn't happen.
What didn't happen? The audition?
Nah, I don't know. We'll see.
What's the part?
Vince?
No, what kind of part? Is it good?
Yeah. They were looking for a blonde.
A dark blonde? Because you're not blonde. We entered the play into the New York International Fringe Festival. Jocelyn and our friend Jason produced it, and we sold out every show. I think it was largely because of our tireless grassroots marketing. By grassroots, I mean, of course, environmentally destructive, pest-like papering of the entire boroughs of Manhattan and Brooklyn. Each of us took stacks of postcards and put them in every diner, indie record store, and frite shop we could find. This was in the eight-month window in 2002 where frites were incredibly popular. We didn't want to pay a director to direct the show, so Bren and I directed it ourselves. It was a given that we would also star in it, not just because it was fun, but because, again, we didn't want to pay anyone. Our cheapness was the recurring source of our creative decisions. The set was minimal, and we wore guys' clothes that we borrowed from Brenda's brothers, Jeff and Terry. We had no idea what we were doing, but we had a purpose after 2 years of living in New York and not having one. Matt and Ben was a respite from helplessness. In 2002, the Fringe Festival named us best play of all 500 shows. The New Yorker wrote of the show, "Goofy, funny, and improbably believable. Kaling and Withers have created one of the most appealing male bonding stories since Damon and Pythias," or Oscar and Felix. That quote was easy to access because I have it tattooed on my clavicle. This is when our lives started to change. Producers got in touch with us to transfer the show off Broadway. We got a director, we got a budget, and we could finally return our costumes to Brenda's brothers. The show went up at PS 122, a beautiful theater in the East Village that at one point had been a public school. There's a special level of cool for buildings in Manhattan that have at one point been something else. Someone might say to you knowingly, "Oh, did you know that this theater used to be a zipper factory?" Or, "You obviously know that this discotheque used to be a church, right?" Or, "We are eating in a restaurant that at one point was a typhoid containment center." That's what I love about New York. If Rikers Island ever goes under, I know Andre Balazs will have that place turned into a destination hotel for urban metrosexuals within a month, tops. People will sit in their cell slash hotel rooms and say, "You know a convicted sex offender used to live in this cell, right?" The solitary confinement unit will be the honeymoon suite. The show was short enough that we could do two shows a night. That in itself was challenging because in the play, the 21-year-old Ben tries to impress Matt by chugging an entire 12-ounce bottle of apple juice in one gulp. So I actually gulped 24 ounces of apple juice in one night, though the apple juice was diluted. As I've written about in great detail in this book, I'm no dainty girl, but I'm not a camel either, and doing that twice in one evening was pretty nauseating. Word of mouth from The Fringe helped sales. Nicole Kidman and Steve Martin coincidentally came to the show on the same night, and before long, the show was selling out so much that we had to add a third performance a night. This meant three bottles of diluted apple juice. By the third curtain call of the night, I had to consciously tell myself not to barf when he took our bows. I have never been so excited to hold back vomit. Bloodshed. On the night that Bruce Weber of the New York Times was reviewing the show, I accidentally punched Brenda in the face and broke her nose. How does one accidentally fracture the face of one's best friend? Well, in my defense, there is a fight sequence in the play. It happens towards the very end. Matt has been so antagonized by Ben's immaturity that he tells him he has no talent. Ben, in the heat of the moment, punches Matt in the face. It was a choreographed punch that we had worked on for weeks. But, I don't know, maybe I was drunk on apple juice because my fist connected with her nose. It made a funny little cracking noise, which I should probably note that Brenda did not immediately recognize as funny. That's because Brenda was too busy bleeding. Her shirt was instantly soaked with blood. Noses, for the record, bleed like crazy. It looked like I had stabbed her in the face. The audience collectively gasped. There was a long beat of confused silence, during which Bren looked at the blood in her hand, and then up at me. Then the house manager turned on the lights and Bren ran off stage. Brenda held paper towels to her bleeding face, and I stood by her dumbly, completely in shock at what I had done. Our director, David Warren, appeared backstage moments later. He walked over to us briskly, with the imperturbable cool of a soldier who dismantles explosives for a living. "You have to finish. The show must go on. Go." There was no pussyfooting or assessing our comfort levels. We just had to do it. I had never heard anyone say the phrase, "the show must go on," in the literal sense. Brenda wrapped a makeshift bandage around her nose and valiantly went back on stage. We finished the last 10 minutes of the play, took a bow to a standing ovation from an impressed, if horrified, crowd, then jumped in a cab and headed to the emergency room of St. Vincent's. Bren's nose was officially broken. Years later, she acquiesced. It took her a weekend to not be mad at me anymore. But I think it was actually a full week before she forgave me. I don't blame her, though. Bren had a perfect nose. It's still pretty perfect, but now it has a tiny bump in it, which she good-naturedly pretends she likes. I guess the lesson is that if you're going to punch someone in the face, your best bet is to punch your best friend. Counterintuitive, I know. Bruce Weber gave us a great review in the Times and also a separate little write-up about the nose incident. The publicity drove sales even more. People were curious about this weird 60-minute East Village play starring cross-dressers, during which at any moment physical violence might erupt. Great press from Rolling Stone and Time gave the producers confidence that the show could move to Los Angeles. So while there was a production going on at PS 122, we started another one in L.A. Emotional bloodshed. Matt and Ben was invited to the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, which was a big deal because HBO sponsored the festival and the place was full of powerful Hollywood execs. Only later would I realize that someone wasn't powerful simply because they had the title of exec and a company had paid for him to travel. Actually, the fact that he could be shipped away from Los Angeles for a week meant he was less powerful. Aspen looked the way I had always imagined Switzerland to be, right down to the beautiful blonde women walking around in shearling coats with fur pom-poms. Aspen is one of those places that looks rustic, but where everything is actually sickeningly expensive. This was on a whole other level from New York, which was just plain old grossly expensive. Aspen was so expensive, I was surprised it wasn't entirely populated with the children of Middle Eastern oil moguls. We were put up at a Days Inn-style motel on the edge of town, but made the smart decision, upon waking up in the morning, of moving our hangout time to the lobbies of the fanciest hotels. One day, we snuck into the gym at the St. Regis and did the elliptical machines for 20 exhilarating, frightening minutes. And then the show. How do I say that audiences in Aspen completely hated our show without you thinking I'm exaggerating? They hated the show. This was a festival designed for stand-up comedy and sketches, and we were the only play, which made us the longest show by a good 30 minutes. Even worse, we were in an auditorium so huge, it could have doubled as a venue to announce the NFL draft. What worked so well in the intimacy of an off-Broadway black box theater lost its charm in this cavernous space. It was like staging a flea circus at the Rose Bowl. Though, come to think of it, flea circus probably better describes the attention span of our audiences. People kept getting up to leave in the middle of the play. We'd hear the door open, light would stream in, and then we'd hear the conversation the leavers would have with the people waiting in line for the act scheduled to follow us. When is this going to be over? How much longer? There's supposed to be a sketch show in this venue about guys playing with their testicles after this. Failing upward. I'll chalk it up to good agenting that Mark Prevacero, our agent, was able to parlay Matt and Ben into a pilot deal. Mark was passionate, young, and did charming things like disappear to Costa Rica and send us bottles of hot sauce in the mail. He could also switch from making small talk to becoming fiercely intense about our careers, making unwavering eye contact with his blue eyes. He's the kind of guy you could see successfully carrying off an Aaron Sorkin monologue, but in real life. If he ever quit show business, he could be the leader of a successful cult. It goes without saying that he was a killer agent. Our pilot, based on our lives in Brooklyn, was set up at a network that no longer exists, which I will call SHT, or shit. The pilot was called Mindy and Brenda. It was supposed to be Laverne and Shirley, but sexier, I guess, or like Mork and Mindy replacing the alien character with Brenda, the sensible earthling. We had a group of producers for the project, a few of whom I still think of with great affection. One was the legendary Tom Werner, who produced The Cosby Show and Roseanne. Tom would mention offhandedly that he'd caught a great baseball game the night before, and we later realized he was talking about sitting in his box at Fenway Park, watching the Boston Red Sox, the Major League Baseball team he owned. I liked Tom a lot because he never got flustered or anxious ever. We could burst into his office with Nancy Grace-level anger over a network note, and Tom would sit back in his chair and distract us with a great anecdote about Bill Cosby. He was our wise, tan, and detached uncle. When we wrote the show, we assumed that we would be playing the parts of Mindy and Brenda. This turned out to be a misguided assumption because shit had no intention of ever allowing that. We were told that we would have to audition for the parts of Mindy and Brenda. Mindy and Brenda. I don't know why we were surprised. Shit at the time was a network known largely for casting models to act in television programs and hoping audiences would enjoy good-looking people saying lines they had learned phonetically. If I sound bitter, it's because I am still a little bitter. Who wouldn't be? If you were ever considering sitting in a room with a group of actresses who bear a passing resemblance to you but are much, much thinner and more conventionally attractive, don't do it. You might think it has value as an anthropological exercise, but it doesn't. It made me feel terrible. I was sitting in an audition room with a bunch of girls who were the after picture to my before. My audition for Bombay Dreams was Christmas morning compared to this. This is how I found out that I could convincingly play Ben Affleck, but not Mindy Kaling. The network cast two stunningly pretty and perfectly sweet actresses. By the time we shot the pilot, though, the script made little sense. It suffered from the daily changes made by the shit execs, who put too much stock in what is cool now. Being zeitgeisty was the biggest criterion for the show. Being funny was maybe fifth important. After wardrobe choices, hairstyling, cross-promotional opportunities with advertisers, and edgy sound effects. By the time we shot the script, Mindy and Brenda bore no resemblance to us, figuratively or literally. I believe in the shooting draft, they were both fashion bloggers who worked at a cupcake bakery and were constantly referring to their iPods. This was 2004, when iPods were the white-hot reference. I am not proud of that script. The pilot didn't get picked up, my agents were disappointed, and I was very, very happy. I had had so little Hollywood experience that I wasn't smart enough to know that this was a big career setback. I was just relieved that that show wouldn't go forward with my name on it. The only other thing I had keeping me in Los Angeles was that I'd been hired as a staff writer for 6 episodes of a mid-season NBC show that was a remake of a British show called The Office. Notice how I laid in all that dramatic irony here? Like in Titanic, when Kate Winslet's character loved those weird paintings by that little-known artist named Picasso, and in the audience of the theater, you were laughing to yourself because you knew Picasso turned out to be kind of a big deal. Hollywood, my good friend who is also a little embarrassing. Types of women in romantic comedies who are not real. When I was a kid, Christmas vacation meant renting VHS copies of romantic comedies from Blockbuster and watching them with my parents at home. Sleepless in Seattle was big, and so was When Harry Met Sally. I laughed along with everyone else at the scene when Meg Ryan fakes an orgasm at the restaurant without even knowing what an orgasm was. In my mind, she was just being kind of loud and silly at a diner, and that was hilarious enough for me. I love romantic comedies. I feel almost sheepish saying that because the genre has been so degraded in the past 20 years or so that admitting you like these movies is essentially an admission of mild stupidity, but that has not stopped me from watching them. I enjoy watching people fall in love on screen so much that I can suspend my disbelief for the contrived situations that only happen in the heightened world of romantic comedies. I have come to enjoy the moment when the normal lead guy, say, slips and falls right on top of the expensive wedding cake. I actually feel robbed when the female lead's dress doesn't get torn open at the baseball game when the Jumbotron is on her. I simply regard romantic comedies as a subgenre of sci-fi, in which the world created therein has different rules than my regular human world. Then I just lap it up. There is no difference between Ripley from Alien and any Katherine Heigl character. They're all participating in the same level of made-up awesomeness, and I enjoy every second of it. So it makes sense that in this world, there are specimens of women that I do not think exist in real life. Like Vulcans or UFO people or whatever. Here they are. The Klutz. When a beautiful actress is in a movie, executives rack their brains to find some kind of flaw in her that still allows her to be palatable. She can't be overweight or not perfect looking because who would want to see that? A not 100% perfect looking in every way female? You might as well film a dead squid decaying on the beach somewhere for 2 hours. So they make her a klutz. The 100% perfect-looking female is perfect in every way, except that she constantly falls down. She bonks her head on things. She trips and falls and spills soup on her affable date. Josh Lucas. Is that his name? I know it's two first names. Josh George? Brad Mike? Fred Tom? Yes, it's Fred Tom. Our klutz clangs into stop signs while riding a bike, and knocks over giant displays of expensive fine china. Despite being 5'9" and weighing 110 pounds, she is basically like a drunk buffalo who has never been a part of human society. But Fred Tom loves her anyway. The Ethereal Weirdo. The smart and funny writer Nathan Rabin coined the term manic pixie dream girl to describe a version of this archetype after seeing Kirsten Dunst in the movie Elizabethtown. This girl can't be pinned down and may or may not show up when you make concrete plans. She wears gauzy blouses and braids. She decides to dance in the rain and weep uncontrollably if she sees a sign for a missing dog or cat. She spins a globe, places her finger on a random spot, and decides to move there. This ethereal weirdo abounds in movies, but nowhere else. If she were from real life, people would think she was a homeless woman and would cross the street to avoid her, but she is essential to the male fantasy that even if a guy is boring, he deserves a woman who will find him fascinating and pull him out of himself by forcing him to go skinny dipping in a stranger's pool. The woman who is obsessed with her career and is no fun at all. I, Mindy Kaling, basically have two full-time jobs. I regularly work 16 hours a day, But like most of the other people I know who are similarly busy, I think I'm a pretty pleasant, normal person. I am slightly offended by the way that busy working women my age are presented in film. I'm not like always barking orders with my hands-free phone device and telling people constantly, "I have no time for this." I didn't completely forget how to be nice or feminine because I have a career. Also, since when does having a job necessitate women having their hair pulled back in a severe tight bun? Often this uptight woman had to relearn how to seduce a man because her estrogen leaked out of her from leading so many board meetings. And she has to do all sorts of crazy, unnecessary crap, like eat a hot dog in a libidinous way or something. If you're a woman, having a challenging job in movies means the compassionate, warm, or sexy side of your brain has fallen out. The 42-year-old mother of the 30-year-old male lead. I am so accustomed to this young mom phenomenon that when I saw a poster for the proposal, I wondered for a second if the proposal in the movie was Ryan Reynolds suggesting he send his mother, Sandra Bullock, to an old age home. However, given the popularity of teen moms right now, this could actually be the wave of the future. The sassy best friend. You know that really horny and really hilarious best friend who is always asking about your relationship and has nothing really going on in her own life? She always wants to go with you to coffee or wants to go to Bloomingdale's to sample perfumes. She runs a chic dildo store in the West Village? Nope. Okay, that's this person. The skinny woman who is beautiful and toned but also gluttonous and disgusting. Again, I am more than willing to suspend my disbelief during a romantic comedy for good set decoration alone. One pristine kitchen from a Nancy Meyers movie like in It's Complicated is worth five Diane Keatons being caught half-clad in a topiary or whatever situation her character has found herself in. But sometimes even my suspended disbelief isn't enough. I am speaking of the gorgeous and skinny heroine who is also a disgusting pig when it comes to food. And everyone in the movie, her parents, her friends, her boss, are all complicit in this huge lie. They are constantly telling her to stop eating and being such a glutton. And this actress, this poor skinny actress who so clearly lost weight to play the likable lead, has to say things like, "Shut up, you guys, I love cheesecake. If I want to eat an entire cheesecake, I will." If you look closely, you can see this woman's ribs through the dress she's wearing. That's how skinny she is, this cheesecake-loving cow. You wonder, as you sit and watch this movie, what the characters would do if they were confronted by an actual average American woman. They would kill themselves, which would actually be kind of an interesting movie. The woman who works in an art gallery. How many freaking art galleries are out there? Are people constantly buying visual art or something? This posh slash smart slash classy job is a favorite in movies. It's in the same realm as kindergarten teacher in terms of accessibility. Guys don't really get it, but the trappings of it are likable and non-threatening. Art gallery woman, dust off the Rothko. We have an important buyer coming into town, and this is a really big deal for my career. I have no time for this. This is one of those rare cliches that actually has a male counterpart. Whenever you meet a handsome, charming, successful man in a romantic comedy, the heroine's friend always says the same thing. He's really successful. He's an, say it with me, architect. There are like 9 people in the entire world who are architects, and one of them is my dad. None of them look like Patrick Dempsey. All about the office. The office is a big chapter in my life, so that's why it's a big chapter in my book. It's what I'm best known for, and it's what people ask me about the most. I'd like to be cool enough to say I'm sick of talking about it, the way Jennifer Lopez doesn't want to talk about her butt anymore. But The Office is still a significant part of my life, and I think it's awesome. So, here we go. People are always asking me what my castmates on The Office are really like. Is Steve Carell really as nice as he seems? Is John Krasinski as cool as Jim in real life? What about Rainn Wilson? Is he as big an egomaniac as Dwight? The answers are yes, yes, and much, much worse. I love watching The Real Housewives of any city, so I have an appreciation for lunatic divas. So, it is a little disappointing that there aren't any on our show. Sure, there are occasional tantrums and arguments, and as I've said, Rainn is the absolute worst. But other than that, there's not too much to tell. We don't have any sensational meltdowns if, say, catering accidentally puts chickpeas in a star salad. Actually, wait, maybe I'm that person. I will throw a salad across the room if there are chickpeas in it, I swear to God. Because people on set are so normal, I'm usually very happy to dish about them. But I walk away from these encounters slightly disturbed because I realize no one wonders what I'm like in real life because they assume I am Kelly Kapoor. Obviously, this confusion is not something I would mind if I was playing Lara Croft or a Supreme Court Justice or Serena Williams or something, but when you're playing a bit of a selfish, boy-crazy narcissist, it's a concern. And even though I'm a writer and producer, and sometimes director, technically making me a quadruple threat, what of it, of the series, people tend to forget this in the face of the fact that the character Kelly and I both love shopping. To clear things up, here's a list of some differences between us as I see it. Things Kelly would do that I would not. Fake a pregnancy for attention. Fake a rape for attention. Text while showering. Consider driving away from the site of a vehicular manslaughter. Plant evidence of cheating in order to confront a boyfriend. Cry about a celebrity breakup. Write a letter of support to Jennifer Aniston. Write a mean anonymous letter to Lance Armstrong regarding Sheryl Crow. Use a voodoo doll. Create an online persona to cyberbully a girl into being anorexic. Blackmail a boyfriend into taking her out to dinner. Things Kelly and I would both do. Choreograph and star in a music video. Fake our own deaths to catch a serial killer. Cry at work occasionally. Memorize our credit card numbers to shop online with ease. Drive with our parking brake on. Go to goop.com every day. Spend hours following a difficult recipe, hate the way it tastes, and throw it out to go get McDonald's. Get upset if we're not invited to a party. Go on trendy and slightly dangerous diets. Hold a royal wedding viewing party. Some of the world's best comedians successfully play versions of themselves, like Woody Allen, Tina Fey, Ray Romano, and Larry David. But I am not doing that with Kelly. You'll all get to see me ingeniously playing a version of myself when I do my own show, Mindy Kaling, Escaped War Criminal Hunter. Flying to Bolivia to extradite or execute Nazis? That is so quintessentially me. I have the opportunity to write for Kelly, but more often than not, I am not really able to. When you write an episode of The Office, you are required to be on set supervising the shooting of your episode. If I'm acting as Kelly, that means I can't be supervising set as producer because I'm too busy acting in a scene, and so I have less control over the overall quality of the episode. Believe me, I'd love for Kelly to be in the show more, slowly encroaching on the lead's airtime until the show is renamed My Name is Kelly, or ABCDEFGHIJ Kelly. But given how many characters we have, the tertiary characters like Kelly tend to have one or two great lines per episode. Wait, what's the thing that comes after tertiary? That's Kelly. Long pauses with Greg Daniels, getting hired in the first season. People ask me all the time how I got hired onto The Office. Another common question is, how do I manage to stay so down to earth in the face of such incredible success? This I can't explain. It probably has something to do with innate goodness or something. A third frequently asked question is,
girl, where you from? Trinidad, Guyana, Dominican Republic? You married? You got kids? What's your situation?
This is mostly asked by guys on the sidewalk selling I Love New York paraphernalia in New York City. My career in Hollywood is owed to a man named Greg Daniels. He and his wife, Suzanne, saw Matt and Ben, and soon after, I got a call from my agent, Mark, who told me that Greg wanted to meet me for a general. General is short for general meeting, which is one of the most vague and dreaded of Hollywood inventions. It essentially means, I am curious about you, but I don't want to have a meal with you, and I want there to be little expectation of any tangible outcome from our meeting. Most of the time with generals, neither person knows exactly why they are meeting the other person, so you talk about LA traffic patterns and which celebrities are looking too thin these days. The meetings are fun if you like chatting, which I do, but frustrating if you like moving forward with your life, which I also do. But usually you get a free bottle of water. I was incredibly nervous meeting Greg, because his reputation preceded him. Even my dad knew who he was, because of the opening credits of King of the Hill, one of the only animated shows he didn't think was destroying the minds of American youth. Greg had been on the staff of the Harvard Lampoon, a writer for Saturday Night Live, where he was writing partners with Conan O'Brien, The Simpsons and Seinfeld, and created King of the Hill. If he'd died just after doing that, people still would have been sad to read his obituary. When I met him, he had just turned 40. I got to the meeting early. It was held at the King of the Hill offices in Century City. Century City is a commercial business area with lots of gleaming high-rises. To help you visualize it, it is the area where Alan Rickman held all those people hostage in Die Hard. A bored 20-something guy greeted me at reception. Actually, he did not greet me. It took him a full minute or so before he looked away from his computer game to acknowledge me standing nervously in front of his desk. When people show a lack of excitement to see me, I compensate by complimenting the hell out of them. I focused on his tidy work area. Me. What a clean desk. If it were mine, it'd be a disaster, haha.
This isn't my desk. They moved me here when the season ended. I literally have nothing to do with this desk.
We stared at each other for a few moments until he told me to sit down next to a full-size cutout of Peggy Hill. Mark had warned me that Greg was a little quiet and pensive, but no one could have warned me just how quiet and pensive. Greg is the frequent perpetrator of crazy long pauses in conversation, like minutes long. My meeting with him was 2.5 hours, but if you transcribed it, it would have had the content of a 15-minute conversation. Greg would reference all kinds of books and articles, and instead of paraphrasing them like any normal lazy person, he'd insist on going online and finding the exact quote or line from the secondary source, adding another 5-minute silent section to the meeting, during which he wordlessly surfed online. Later, I would realize this is Greg's signature style. He likes to take in a person past the point where they can be putting on a show to impress him. Or, this is my interpretation, he might just have been zoning out and forgot I was there. Greg's a very low-key guy, with the bearing of a gentle athletic scientist. We talked about New Hampshire, our dads, books, and elaborate Indian weddings. It was fun, and I unexpectedly learned a lot. I remember leaving the meeting with a few printouts. One was MapQuest directions to a diner Greg loved eating at called John O'Groats, and the other was an article about the history of an architecturally interesting library where Greg had gone to high school. Now I should give some context of that year in television. NBC had high hopes for 3 comedies that year. Committed, a show about eccentric friends living together in New York City, an animated show, Father of the Pride, and Joey, the spinoff of Friends. I could not get meetings with any of these hot shows. Like, not even close. Mark hustled and got me a meeting with only one other show, Nevermind Nirvana, a pilot about an interracial married couple. I drove to Burbank to meet with the executives. When I was sitting in the waiting area, the producer got a call. The show had not gotten picked up. The receptionist informed me of the news and immediately started packing her stuff up in a box. I validated my parking and left. I literally didn't even make it into the room. So technically, meeting Greg was my first and only staffing meeting in my career. A week or so later, Mark called and told me Greg wanted to hire me as a staff writer for season 1 of The Office. Before I could get too excited, he let me know that I had been hired for 6 episodes for a show that was premiering mid-season. This was the smallest amount of contracted work you could do and still qualify for Writers Guild membership. I didn't care. I was a television writer with health benefits. Friendless, I celebrated the best way I could. I went straight to Cantor's Deli, sat in a booth, and ordered a huge frosty Coke and a sandwich called the Brooklyn Ave, a less healthy version of the Reuben, if that is possible, and gabbed with my best friends and my mom on the phone for 2 hours. An elderly man who was eating with his wife at a nearby table came over to my booth.
You're being very loud and rude. Your voice is so high-pitched and piercing.
I started work in July. At that time, I lived alone in a small, damp apartment I found on Fairfax Ave and Fountain Boulevard, which I did not know was the nexus of all transvestite social life in West Hollywood. I did not even have the basic LA savvy to ask my landlord for a parking space, so I parked blocks away from my house and enjoyed late-night interactions with strangely tall, flat-chested women named Felice or Vivica, who always wanted rides to the valley. If my life at the time had been a sitcom, an inebriated tranny gurgling,
"Hey, girl,"
would have been my norm. A giant billboard for a gay sex chat line was 20 feet away from my apartment door. You have to understand, this was before I became the international and fabulous gay icon that I am today, so it made me uncomfortable. Now I'm basically Lady Gaga and Gavin Newsom times a million. When my parents came to visit me, I would try to distract them from seeing it by pointing across the street to a Russian produce market, which I was 70% sure was a front for a crime consortium. Isn't that cool, Mom and Dad? I get all my produce locally. My parents visited a lot. It was a lonely time. I started to look forward to my encounters with Felice and Vivica.
Hey, curry spice.
Hey, girlfriend. But mostly, I just wanted to start work. Being a staff writer was very stressful. I knew I was a funny person, but I was so inexperienced in this atmosphere. Joking around with Brenda and writing plays on the floor of our living room in Brooklyn was intimate and safe, and entwined in our friendship. But I wasn't friends with these guys. I was the only staff writer on the show, the others outranked me, and had never been in a writer's room. Most of the stress came, honestly, because the other writers were so experienced and funny, and I was worried I couldn't keep up. I was scared Greg would notice this inequity of talent and that he'd fire me in a 2-hour pause-laden meeting. I dreaded the pauses more than the firing. The full-time writers for season one were Greg, Paul Lieberstein, Mike Schur, BJ Novak, and me. For some reason, I thought Greg, BJ, and Mike were all best friends, because they had all gone to Harvard and been on the Harvard Lampoon, even though their times at Harvard didn't even overlap. I'll never forget one day at lunch when Mike asked BJ to go to a Red Sox-Dodgers game with him while I stewed angrily on the other side of the room feeling left out. I'll get you, you clicky sons of bitches, I thought. You know what? I never did get them. I'm just realizing now. I should totally still get them. But as is the case with most people you're stuck with for many hours, they slowly became my good friends. The job of comedy writer is essentially to sit and have funny conversations about hypothetical situations, and you are rewarded for originality of detail. It is exhilarating, and I didn't want it to stop. I soon started dreading the weekends because weekends meant saying goodbye to this creative, cheerful atmosphere. I will always remember Chappelle's Show very fondly, because besides being one of the funniest shows ever, it served as my good friend at the time. I'd watch every episode and then watch them again later that day to hear the jokes again. Sometimes on a Saturday night, I would fall asleep watching it on my sofa. Like, Dave Chappelle and I were best friends chatting until we fell asleep. I was 24. I didn't know at the time that this year with Greg, Paul, BJ, and Mike would be where I essentially learned how to write comedy. This small group wrote the first 6 episodes of that first season of The Office. They were, and are, 4 of my favorite people in the world. They are also the 4 funniest people I know. I have fought bitterly with them, too. I mean, real fights, knockdown dragouts, which I'll rationalize to mean that they are my true friends. I won't say any more about them, because none of them are lacking in confidence, and honestly, they're like 3 compliments away from becoming monsters. Writer fights, or don't fight with Greg Daniels. Writer fights are always exciting and traumatic, and I get into them all the time. I am a confident writer, a hothead, and have a very thin skin for any criticism. This charming combination of personality traits makes me an argument machine on our staff. A halfway compliment my friend and The Office showrunner Paul Lieberstein once paid me was, "It's a good thing that you turn in good drafts because you are impossible to rewrite, Mindy." Thanks, Paul. All I heard was, "Mindy, you are the best writer we have ever had. I cherish you. We all do." I tend to fight with Greg the most. My friend and fellow office writer Steve Healy believes it is because I am emotional and intuitive, and Greg is more cerebral and logical. Or, as I like to think of it, I am a sensitive poet and Greg is a mean robot. Our fighting is legendary. One time, late at night, our script coordinator Sean and our head writer Danny both brought in their dogs, and upon seeing each other, they got into a violent barking fight. Paul Lieberstein glanced over and joked, "Oh, I thought that was just Greg and Mindy." What do we fight about? I wish I could say there were big, smart, philosophical issues about writing or comedy, but sometimes they're as small as, "If we do that cold open where Kevin dumps a tureen of chili on himself, I will quit this show." We did that cold open, by the way, and it was a hit, and I'm still working at the show. I can get a little theatrical, which makes sense because, after all, I came up through the theater, said in my snootiest Masterpiece Theater voice. I will tell you about the worst fight we ever had. In a very heated rewrite session for the season 3 episode Grief Counseling, I was arguing with Greg so much, he finally said in front of all 12 writers, "If you're going to resist what I'm doing here, you can just go home, Mindy." Greg never sends anyone home or even hints at it. Greg is the kind of guy who is so agreeable, I frequently find him on our studio lot embroiled in some long, boring conversation with a random person while his lunch is getting cold in his to-go container. And he's a boss. I would never talk to anyone if I was the boss. I would only talk to my attorney and my psychic. So anyway, my very nice boss had just hugely reprimanded me. Greg suggesting I go home unless I adjusted my attitude was the harshest he'd ever been to anyone in the 3 years I'd been on the show. There was silence. No one looked at me. People pretended to be absorbed in their phones. One writer didn't even have a phone, he just pretended to be absorbed in his hand. I was so embarrassed and angry that I got up, stomped out of the room, stole a 24-pack of bottled water from the production office, kicked the bumper of Greg's car, and left the studio. This is what I get for trying to make the show better? I am a funnier and better writer than every single one of these assholes, I thought angrily. I pictured myself accepting the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor at the Kennedy Center, and all those other writers watching from home with the hope that I might acknowledge them, and I pointedly wouldn't. Instead, I'd thank Thalia, the Greek muse of comedy. I'd freaking thank Thalia over those guys. I drove to a nail salon in a mini mall a mile away and angrily sat down for a manicure. Signora has the day off? The woman soaking my nails asked me congenially. Nope, I got kicked out of work, I replied. She stopped what she was doing. Oh, you fired? She asked, concerned. Hearing her say fired sent a spiky shudder down my spine. I looked at my soaking cuticles. I saw the soft hands of a babied comedy writer who had never known a hard day's work. Did I really want to be unemployed? Did I want to jeopardize this amazing job I had dreamed about having since I was 13? Did I really want to be a receptionist at my mother's OBGYN office, where I would need to learn Spanish? I immediately stood up, dried my hands, handed some cash to the puzzled woman, and raced back to work. I quietly entered the writer's room and sat down. My friend and fellow writer, Lee Eisenberg, looked at me quizzically and texted, "Where have you been?" I texted back, "The bathroom." Greg did not acknowledge my absence or find out that I'd kicked his car and it blew over. The bottles of water remained mine. Wahaha! That evening, when I had my nightly chat with my mother on the way home from work, I made the mistake of telling her about what had happened. I was hoping to get consoled for a bad day at work. Instead, she yelled at me, "Are you crazy? You owe everything to Greg Daniels." Mom always says, "Greg Daniels," as though there were a few people at work with the first name Greg and I might not know who she was talking about. There aren't. Greg Daniels took a chance on you and changed your life. Don't fight with Greg Daniels. Dad got on the phone from the upstairs line, as he always does. He agreed with Mom. "I know you get upset, Min, but you have to be professional." I am still trying to follow this terrific advice, only somewhat successfully, 5 years later. Steve Carell is nice, but it is scary. It has been said many times, but it is true. Steve Carell is a very nice guy. His niceness manifests itself mostly in the fact that he never complains. You could screw up a handful of takes outside in 104-degree, smog-choked Panorama City heat, and Steve Carell's final words before collapsing of heat stroke would be a friendly and hopeful, "Hey, do you think we have that shot yet?" I have always found Steve gentlemanly and private, like a Jane Austen character. The one notable thing about Steve's niceness is that he is also very smart. And that kind of niceness has always made me nervous. When smart people are nice, it's always terrifying because I know they're taking everything in and thinking all kinds of smart and potentially judgmental things. Steve could never be as funny as he is or as darkly observational an actor without having an extremely acute sense of human flaw. As a result, I'm always trying to impress him in the hope that he'll go home and tell his wife, Nancy, "Mindy was so funny and cool on set today. She just gets it." Getting Steve to talk shit was one of the most difficult 7-year challenges, but I was determined to do it. A circle of actors could be in a fun, excoriating conversation about, say, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and you'd shoot Steve an encouraging look that said, "Hey, come over here. We've made a space for you. We're trashing Dominique Strauss-Kahn to Bill Castropore." And the best he might offer is, "Wow, if all they say about him is true, that is nuts." And then politely excuse himself to go to his trailer. That's it. That's all you get. Can you believe that? He just would not engage. That is some willpower there. I, on the other hand, hear someone briefly mentioning rain, and I'll immediately launch into, "Oh my God, rain's so horrible. Can I tell you all about it?" But Carell is just one of those infuriating, classy Jane Austen guys. Later, I would privately theorize that he has never involved himself in gossip because, and I am 99% sure of this, he is secretly Perez Hilton. Where I work. Many people assume The Office is shot in Scranton, Pennsylvania, because we take pains to shoot on locations that are green and East Coast looking. Other people think we shoot on a picturesque studio lot. like you see on the tour of Universal Studios, where Jaws is swimming happily near the Desperate Housewives cul-de-sac and down the block from an immolating car from the Backdraft set. Not so. Anyone who comes to visit the set of The Office always says the same thing when they leave. Holy crap, that was scary. This is because we shoot at the end of a dead-end street on an industrial block of Panorama City in the San Fernando Valley, which sounds great. Who doesn't love panoramas? But don't be fooled. The name is a trick. At one point, Panorama City was part of Van Nuys, but Van Nuys did whatever the opposite of secede is to it. Expelled it? I'll put it this way. Van Nuys took one look at Panorama City and was like, get your own name. We don't want to have anything to do with you. We're at the end of a block with a gun parts warehouse, a neon sign store, and a junkyard. Our street is also a favored drag racing strip for competitive, bored Mexican teenagers. We're always having to stop filming and wait for the noise to die down from junkyard dogs barking and gun parts being drilled. Come to think of it, there might actually be an immolating car around here once in a while. Take that, Universal Studios. I love our set because we are isolated from other shows. Isolation is good because there are no distractions to the work, and believe me, I get distracted easily. There is no cool shopping or dining or anything near us whatsoever, so we can only focus on working on the show. It makes us feel sequestered and secluded, which I think is good for my creativity. Also, I can run out any time and buy my gun parts. Kelly Kapoor gets gift bags. When I started attending events associated with The Office, I started to receive gift bags. I'd recall breathless accounts from magazines of gifts like sapphire earrings, lifetime memberships to fancy gyms, gift certificates for total facial reconstruction plastic surgery, week-long stays at wildlife reserves where you get to touch the lions, and $500 jars of miracle face cream made from human placenta. It seemed like the greatest racket ever, and in 2006, I started to participate in it. The way it works is you go to an award show for which you've spent a crazy amount of money getting dressed up. After you win or lose in your categories, there is a non-televised portion of the evening where you and every other person at the event gets herded into a giant windowless room and fed a hot buffet of food on par with a medium fancy bar mitzvah. The thing is, the food tastes insanely good because you've not eaten anything all day. After mingling for a little while and mentally ranking the gowns of all the other actresses so you can call your mom and give her the scoop, you trade in a parking ticket-like stub to some stressed-out-looking woman at the exit, and she gives you a black canvas bag packed with goodies. You get really excited, and then you open it up. What I have gotten in my gift bags over the years: protein bars, a personal hygiene spray that I can only describe as a butt freshener, socks with individual toes, a travel-sized tube of toothpaste for women's teeth, a SpongeBob SquarePants keychain, a mechanical pencil. Kind of cool, actually, but it was instantly stolen when I took it to work. Weird coffee pods that work only if you buy the coffee machine that the pods are made for. Tan silicone cutlets you glue to your real breasts. A crotchless girdle meant to hold your back fat in. A children's book written by a lead in the original Beverly Hills 90210. The gift bags are junk bags. I'm not telling you this to complain, but rather to relieve you of any romantic notions you might have of them. Use those romantic notions for something else, like thinking about the significance and grandeur of our national mint. Not only would you never purchase any of the stuff in these gift bags, but you would not even give it to a relative you have a chilly relationship with. There is, however, one excellent perk we get on our show. I've enjoyed an endless supply of free paper, paper clips, envelopes, and office supplies since joining The Office, because I steal props on a regular basis. Becoming a little bit famous. When you have it as good as I know I do, work-wise, you rarely have time to enjoy your fabulous good fortune because you're too busy worrying about when it will run out. After the first season of The Office, I remember Jenna Fischer, Angela Kinsey, and I got turned away from a party thrown by a famous magazine at a fancy hotel on Sunset Boulevard. The party coordinators didn't think being on The Office warranted our getting in. We stood and watched the One Tree Hill cast waltz in with no problem. The PR people at the party regarded us with the disdain normally reserved for on-set tutors for child actors. For the record, there is usually no one weirder on a set than the tutor for child actors. They tend to be these aging hippie ladies with inappropriately long hair tied coquettishly in a messy gray braid and like an all-denim outfit that would put Jay Leno to shame. Luckily, I was not in the aging child tutor stage for too long, though. Midway through season two, we were finally getting recognition due to our track record of a dozen great episodes, and people were into us. It was glorious. The highlight was one Saturday, when I was vacuuming my car at a gas station on Santa Monica Boulevard during the Gay Pride Parade, and a group of gay veterans in uniform shrieked, "Oh my God, it's Kelly Kapoor!" The guys at the gas station thought I was hot shit. Being the It Show in season two presented its own challenges, though. A common refrain we heard was, "I disliked your first season, but by the second season, you really came into your own." I think people thought their compliment meant more if they tempered it with something insulting first. As if I were to say, "I initially thought you were ugly, but then you walked closer to me and I realized you were kind of pretty." I love our first season. I think it is a little dark and really funny. I found the phrase "came into your own" especially weird, as though The Office finally developed breasts or something. What we have to be scared about. What's coming up next is a perennial fear in the television world. Some people who work in the industry confidently ignore all the new good shows, saying, "There's room for lots of good television. This won't affect us." But that's simply not true. There's room for a little good scripted television and many, many reality TV shows about monitored weight loss. If the science were there to genetically clone Jillian Michaels, our network would just be different filmed iterations of obese people losing weight all day long. My friend Charlie Grandy once joked that it is only a matter of time before there is a category at the Emmys for Best Extreme Weight Loss Program. In the spring, when the networks trot out their lineup of new shows, you may idly think, "Meh, maybe I'll try this one or DVR that one." But I get a little paranoid trying to figure out whether any newcomer is going to beat us in a painful death by primetime scheduling. I've made a list of potential shows that I believe would kill The Office in ratings. I want to be able to walk for my wedding. Jillian Michaels helps a morbidly obese couple confined to their sofa lose weight for their nuptials. I want to be able to walk when I officiate a wedding. Jillian Michaels helps an obese priest confined to his parish officiate a wedding. Obese priest. A priest who eats too much dessert helps a group of at-risk but hilarious teens. Sing Sing Sings. A singing competition in Sing Sing Prison. The Weekly Hangover. A reality show where three friends are chloroformed and put in a random dangerous situation, like in the movie The Hangover, and have to piece back what happened to their lives. Interspecies Friendships. Have you ever seen that YouTube video where the elephant is friends with a collie? Or the one where the turtle and the hippopotamus are best friends? I could watch those videos for hours. That is the kind of buddy comedy that people want to see. I actually think I might create Interspecies Friendships. A smart, small, observational show about two animals who are friends against all odds. It'd be a tough sell at first, but by season two, it'll really come into its own. But it'll never be as good as the original British version, Interspecies Chums. Franchises I would like to reboot. By now you've seen what a savvy Hollywood person I am and wonder when I will be making my big jump from television to film. Here's where I explain everything and tell about some of my most exciting film projects in the pipeline. Nobody likes it when Hollywood reboots beloved franchises. When I was hired to write for the NBC remake of the classic BBC show The Office, everyone had the immediate physical reaction of being around someone who had just farted. The thing is, at least we were trying to remake something that was excellent. What I have never understood is the rebooting of already terrible things. For example, take The Dukes of Hazzard. This was a show whose two greatest claims to fame were a car that consistently jumped over large objects at critical moments, and b, introducing America to the Daisy Duke short shorts, which single-handedly lowered the average age of sexual intercourse in this country by several years. I loved the show as a four-year-old, don't get me wrong. But even then, I kind of knew The Dukes of Hazzard was for kids. I thought, this is good for me, or like a five-year-old tops. So when it got remade as a movie, I didn't quite understand. But then I heard how much money it made, and I thought, I need to get in on this pronto. Here are some franchises I would like to reboot, for the love of the franchise, and a little bit for the love of the money that I think I would make. A League of Their Own. Unfortunately, a bit of an uphill battle here. As fun and frothy as this movie was, it was based on an actual historical event. The All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was a real thing. Also, I would reboot this movie only if I can play the Rosie O'Donnell part, and and I'm pretty sure there weren't many Indian women in the United States in the 1940s. The Hulk. I feel like if they're gonna remake this movie every 2 or 3 years anyway, I would like to get a shot at one. Ocean's 5. Let's be real here. The first Ocean's film, not the 1960s Ocean's 11, how old do you think I am? The first Ocean's film was great, but there was already like 4 too many guys in it. Don Cheadle had like 3 lines in the entire movie, and it's Don Cheadle. The films that came after Ocean's 11, where they kept adding people, were hard to follow. There were so many characters doing different Vegas-related missions. It made you feel like someone behind the scenes was out of control, like, oh my god, if we don't stop this person, all of the Screen Actors Guild is going to be in Danny Ocean's gang. That's why we need to do a prequel and cut out all the ragtaggiest of the ragtag bunch. We do that Benjamin Button backward